Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to History Becomes Her, a Mashable podcast about women making history right now and the women who paved the way for them. I'm your host, Rachel Thompson, senior reporter at Mashable. It's rare that a book changes the way you see the world around you, but this book has the potential to change the course of history. A book that, when women read it, confirms everything you've ever felt irritated by and tells you that, no, actually, you weren't imagining these inequalities. Visible Women by Caroline Criado Perez exposes the erasure of women in a world that's been designed by men, for men, and men alone. In this world, women sit shivering in offices set to male temperatures, they hold phones that are too big for their hands, they struggle to reach the rail on the tube set to a male height. We're not collecting data specific to women, and that means that urban planning, transportation, policy, design, science and manufacturing are overlooking the needs of half the world's population. But discomfort is just one part of the puzzle. This data gap is also putting women's lives at risk. Writer and activist Tracy King ran a successful crowdfunding campaign to send a copy of the book to every MP in the country in the hope that lawmakers will take action against the gender data gap at the heart of this systemic discrimination. Those books have now been delivered to every single MP.
My name's Tracy King. I am a writer and producer, and now I am a feminist campaigner.
My name is Caroline Criado Perez. I am also a feminist campaigner.
My first question for both of you, is there a particular female activist from history or even from the present day who's had a profound effect on you?
I mean, obviously Caroline. yes. So Caroline was kind enough to let me interfere a bit when she was campaigning for a statue of a suffragist in Parliament Square. I helped a bit on that, and I learned. I'd not really done any feminist activism before then. I'd done a lot of STEM outreach, a lot of education outreach, and a lot of critical thinking outreach, but not really feminist outreach. And so, being a working class person, I'm not used to sort of just taking permission to do stuff. That's just not the world I live in. I'm used to, you have to ask permission very nicely and they'll say no, and you go, oh, of course, yes, sorry. Sorry to bother you. Off again.
How dare you?
Yeah. And so my own activism was woken, my own feminist activism was woken by Caroline, who is just somebody who will, she's just like, no, this is going to happen. There is going to be a woman on a banknote. And if I have to sue the Bank of England to get it, there is going to be a statue of a woman in Parliament Square. And, you know, if I have to go and stand on a plinth in Parliament Square for a month myself.
And be I'm the statue.
Yeah, and make the point, then that's. And so I just thought, oh, you don't. It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. Okay, let's do that. So obviously I'm going to say Caroline, but also we're very good friends, so I'm very biased. But I do have, I have a sort of, I actually wrote an answer.
Oh,
like
I love that.
Like a weird essay question. So as a sort of activist from history, Mary Wollstonecraft, she was around in the 1700s. So obviously there's lots of sort of modern caveats to her ideas. We have a better understanding of things like class now. But very broadly, she popularized the idea that women are not inferior to men, that the difference is actually in education. Which is a subject very close to my heart. So in those days, that was like the basic human right to an education. We take that for granted now. Girls and boys go to school equally. But in the 1700s, that was absolutely not the case. And so a thing that I say all the time is it's not empowering if it doesn't get you any actual power. By which I usually mean structural power or maybe money. But of course, the root of the actual power of structural power and money power is education. Knowledge is power, which is why men didn't then, and to some degree still do not like when women are educated. A lot of men are really weird about educated women still. And she was one of the first women to say, actually, you know, education is the key to women's emancipation. And she was also one of the first women to try and make a living from writing. She was also very keen on female friendship and collaboration. She had a best friend whose name was Fanny Blood.
Oh my God.
That's actually her name. Fanny Blood.
Oh my God.
They had this sort of feminist fantasy. They wanted to be like roommates in a feminist commune, but they couldn't make it work because in those days, to have enough income independently as working class women, you couldn't actually make that work. But I really loved that she had this sort of collaborative friendship approach to, obviously feminism wasn't invented then, but you know, to her activism, which I feel quite strongly about too, because that, you know, some of my best friends now are women that I've met through feminism, and I just think, you know, that's where your people are. So she wrote Vindication of the Rights of Women during, there was a sort of nature versus nurture debate going on about sensibilities, which was all about that biologically women were, or psychologically, women were too emotional to be capable of rational thought. And science has very thoroughly debunked that idea, but it's still around, weirdly, from my daily Twitter interactions.
Experiencing a resurgence via He Who Shall Not Be Named.
Yes.
The big J. Pity himself.
The lobster man. and so the work started by Mary Wollstonecraft to say, you know, actually women are perfectly capable of rational thought, it's just that we're not educating women. Mm-hmm. That work is still very, very relevant today. And, you know, however far we get here in the West, it's, you know, a major issue, the right of education of girls in the developing world, etc. So I think that, you know, while some of her ideas are very outdated, her sort of core idea of just educate girls and you know, that for me is, I guess that makes her my sort of favourite activist, because that's, I think that's still a thing that we need to do now.
Definitely.
I mean, I also love Mary Wollstonecraft, and she wrote one of my favourite quotations of all time, which is, "Why are girls to be told that they resemble angels, but to sink them below women?" Which I just think is so perfect for summing up the way that we try to make women into these perfect, beautiful, nice creations that means they're not actually allowed to be human beings and elevate, you know, it seems like we're elevating them and actually we are not allowing them to be human. And I just think that that's really important. And sort of the more, I guess, high profile I get, the more important that line seems to me, because I feel the pressure more and more and more to just always be really nice and sweet and never lose my rag and never just have a bad day or anything like that, because then everything I say gets dismissed. And that just is not the case for men. You know, they are allowed to be flawed beings and women are not allowed to have flaws. And I, that makes me furious. So I love Mary Wollstonecraft. But I would say, in terms of who I keep coming back to as someone who inspires me, is actually Millicent Fawcett. And the reason for that is, I just think that what they did was incredible. And I mean that in the literal sense. You know, how could they have imagined that with no structural power whatsoever, that they could get the right to vote? That is incredible. And so whenever I feel that I'm trying to fight for something that's too hard, I do think back to this very first fight, you know, the fight that upon which all other fights were predicated, upon which, you know, all other battles were won. We wouldn't win any of the subsequent battles if we hadn't won that first really important battle. And it must have seemed completely impossible and crazy. And indeed, it was seen like that. And Millicent Fawcett spent her whole life fighting for it. Her whole life. You know, and I bitch and moan about spending 3 years writing a book, or, you know, 2 years trying to get a statue, you know, and that felt like a really long time to me. She spent her whole life on this campaign and she never gave up, you know, the age of 19. And then she was up in the Ladies' Gallery in 1928 watching the Equal Franchise Act being passed. And I just think that that's incredible. And also, I suppose it's partly a sort of, I wish I could be more like her. And I do think that kind of Activism is really important. Yes, I think making a noise is really important, but actually being able to rationally make the argument and make the case is incredibly important. So I really look up to women who do that.
I love that. In the book, you talk about the tangible ways women's lives are being placed at risk. So how is this data gap actually harming women?
It's harming women in pretty much every way you can think of. The way that I came across it, and I think the way that shocks people the most, is in the medical world. So the vast majority of medical data is collected and has been traditionally collected on male bodies. And I say male bodies because it's not just humans, it's also male animals and also male cells, which is where studies start. They start in cells, and even cells, female cells, are too, you know, unpredictable and crazy to be able to test on. And the result is that women have far less effective treatment, far more side effects, and women are more likely to die from all sorts of common diseases like heart disease. Women are more likely to die following a heart attack, basically because all of the diagnostic tests, the symptoms that we recognize, and the treatment has been designed around men. And female heart attacks not only are often symptomatically different, they also are often mechanically different. And so there's just this huge issue of developing treatment for the male body. But then also, you know, there's issues like cars. Cars have traditionally been tested using a 50th percentile male as the test dummy. And that means that all of the safety features and things like, you know, the positioning of the seat, the positioning of the pedals, the positioning of the seat belt, which has never even been tested for how to place it against breast tissue. Oh. All of that means that women are 47% more likely to be seriously injured and 17% more likely to die if they're in a car crash than men. And, you know, it's not just in these sort of tangible ways like health and product design. It's basically everything from the way we design the economy, the way we design the tax system, the way we, you know, what we choose to invest in public services, the way we design transport infrastructure. All of this affects women's lives, from the way they are able to navigate the world to the way they are able to work for in paid work and their unpaid work, and just simply in the way they are able to survive a heart attack.
God, it's going great for us then.
Yeah.
So yeah, when we talk about a gender data gap, what exactly does this term mean?
Basically, it means, you know, as in medicine, the vast majority of all information, all data, has been collected on male bodies and typical male lifestyle patterns. So in medicine, it is, you know, just testing drugs and researching disease. In the economy, it's collecting data about how men live their lives. So the type of paid work that men do, not counting the unpaid work that women do, and not including that in GDP, even though women's unpaid work is a massive contributor to GDP. I mean, for example, in Australia, it's the biggest industry if you were to include women's unpaid care work. But the way that we count GDP, it looks like financial services is Australia's biggest industry. Mm. But actually, women's unpaid childcare is first. Then second is women's unpaid housework services, and then third is the financial services sector.
Right.
And the problem with that is because we don't count it, and no country is collecting this the data on women's unpaid work. Again, in Australia, they were meant to do a time use survey, which is how we collect women's unpaid care work data, in 2013. And they just were like, oh, actually, we can't be bothered to do it. So they just didn't do it. So, you know, in Australia, for example, the most recent data is from 2006.
Wow.
And I, you know, have no idea when the latest data from the UK is. We've probably never done one.
Probably.
But I mean, if you want to sort of think about how this might impact on women in a tangible way, you look at the UK and the way we have been implementing austerity policies. So the research done on that shows that 86% of cuts fell on women. And that is because the public services that the government chose to cut and the tax changes that they chose to make benefited, and this is kind of amazing, it benefited rich men at the expense of poor women, and specifically like the women that were worst hit were single mothers and women from BME communities, because they tend to be the poorest, mm-hmm. And also the most in need of public services. Now, when you look at something like that, which is so clearly massively biased towards men and deeply inequitable for a government that is meant to be supporting the whole of society, you know, you ask yourself, is this because they hate women? Or is it because they design these policies without using evidence and data? And as an optimist, mm-hmm. I like to think that they don't hate women. It's just that they didn't have the data. And as with so many policies that get created by men for men, based on, well, this is the way we've always done stuff, and this probably doesn't matter very much because I would never use that service. You know, they end up cutting these things. Another very good example that I like is the snow clearing in Sweden example. So this town in Sweden called Karlskoga was doing a gender audit of all its local government policies. Isn't that amazing?
That is good.
Imagine
Sweden
if we
is
did
so
that.
Good.
They're so great. They were just doing a gender audit. And they looked at the snow clearing schedule. And despite, you know, what you might think, which is how could snow clearing have anything to do with gender, they discovered actually it has a hell of a lot to do with gender, because it turns out that women and men tend to travel in different ways. And the way they were clearing the snow benefited male travel at the expense of female travel. So what do I mean by that? Well, men are more likely to drive, and they tend to have a much more simple travel pattern than women. They tend to just do a commute in and out of work twice a day. Mm. Women, because again of women's unpaid care work responsibilities, you may be starting to notice a theme developing here, have much more complicated travel patterns, and it's called trip chaining. And women are far more likely to trip chain than men, because they do things like dropping the kids off at school before they go to work, picking up the groceries on the way home, maybe dropping in on an elderly relative. And so they have much more complicated travel patterns, which are not just on a major road. They tend to be in local roads, going through suburbs. And they're much more likely to use public transport, partly because women tend to have less money than men, but also because even households that have a car, men tend to dominate access to them, even in Sweden. So they had been clearing the snow on the major roads first, and then the local roads and pavements second. And again, you know, this was not because the planners who originally devised the schedule hated women and wanted to disadvantage them. It's because they were men. And they thought, well, everyone needs to travel on the roads, so we should definitely clear the major roads first. Mm-hmm. Until they looked at the data and realized, oh, hang on, not everyone travels this way. Maybe we should do it the other way around, because, come on, it's probably easier to drive a car through 3 inches of snow than it is to walk or to push a buggy. Mm. What they didn't expect was that it would have an impact on the healthcare bill, which went down dramatically after just this tiny little shift. And that was because, yes, it is easier to drive a car through 3 inches of snow. And actually 79% of those who were admitted to A&E as a result of falling during icy conditions were pedestrians. And the majority of the pedestrians were women. And women had the worst injuries, the most serious injuries. And the data of the cost to the health budget versus the cost of winter road maintenance was also huge. So it was three times the cost of winter road maintenance. So it's a massive saving to be made just from this tiny little shift of, and just basically shows, I suppose, that closing the gender data gap saves you money.
Definitely.
As well as just being a better thing to do.
So it's in everyone's interest.
It absolutely is. And at the moment, in all sorts of areas, we're basically allocating resources in this blind fashion that we're not taking into account what the needs of half the population are, and it's just foolish on so many levels. Yes, it's inequitable, but also it's just stupid.
So Tracy, when you were reading the book, was there a moment where you were like, yeah, okay, I need the government to do something about this?
Yes, I mean, I think what Caroline's just said, it really highlights the problem, which is that this stuff actually can be a matter of policy. And if our policies are not informed by data and not informed by even just thinking about women, then the knock-on effect affects absolutely everybody in society. So I was fortunate enough to read a sort of early manuscript of the book Caroline had sent to me. And I think I'd started thinking then, this is going to be huge. It's going to be important. What what can I do to help? You know, what can I do to you know, I'm a big data nerd, so I get the idea, but I also recognize that a lot of people, you know, they aren't going to necessarily read a book. Some people are weirdly resistant to that. and some of those people might be in positions of power. So what can I do to put enough sort of pressure on the people in power who make the policies to, you know, at the very least, you can't force somebody to read a book, but, you know, you can get press attention and you can make fuss on Twitter and you can get their constituents to say, have you read this book yet? And the first step is making sure that they definitely, absolutely have a copy. So I went to GoFundMe and I said I would like to raise enough money to send a copy of Caroline's book to every MP. And so we went ahead with the crowdfunding campaign. And the first question I got was, why can't MPs buy their own book?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Which would be a reasonable question if that was the point of the exercise. But the point of the exercise is to say to them, look, this exists and it's a problem. And the data is all in the book, the evidence is all in the book, but also the campaign is a sort of totem for what the solution is, which is you need to just listen to women.
So Caroline, you spent 3 years researching and writing this book. Where did the original idea come from? And like, what was, did you have this aha moment that made you just sit up and think, oh my God, I need to write this book immediately?
So it was discovering the medical health data. It was specifically discovering the heart attacks information. So the idea that, well, first of all, discovering that the heart attack symptoms I had always been taught, and I think most of us are taught, and certainly public health information suggests, are just gender neutral heart attack symptoms, pain in the chest and down the left arm. And then reading that women tend to experience breathlessness, nausea, fatigue, what feels like indigestion. But because public health information is so biased and skewed towards male heart attacks, and by the way, you know, heart disease is the number one killer of women in the US and the second most common killer of women in the UK. So, you know, this is a really big deal.
We need to know about this.
We do need to know about this. Women don't realize they're having a heart attack, and so they don't go to the doctor. But second, and this was what really shocked me, was that doctors are not recognizing the symptoms because we are not training them properly, basically. And I read this in 2014 when I was researching my first book, and I just was absolutely blown away because, you know, I'm a feminist activist, I'm a feminist writer, I knew about, or, you know, I thought I knew about sexism. I thought I knew about the way women are made invisible. And certainly I did know about the way women are made invisible in the media and culture. But the idea that this would extend to science, and not only to science, but to medical science, which is literally studying bodies, and they are only studying the male body, it just blew my mind. And I suppose because of the way that I came into feminism was basically recognizing male default in my own head. So I wasn't at all a feminist growing up. You know, I grew up in the 90s. Feminism was very, very much a dirty word. And we were all like, one of the lads, get our tits out for the lads, you know, all that kind of thing. I mean, you're doing that, but you know you were both doing it.
Definitely did. I was not doing that.
You know, I was definitely the Gillian Flynn cool girl. Anyway, I went to university as a mature student and I had to read this book by a brilliant linguist called Debbie Cameron called Feminism and Linguistic Theory, which may not sound like a cracking read, but it really is. And basically it turned me into a feminist, specifically this particular section where she talks about the use of the generic male in language. So he to mean he or she, man to mean humankind. And I think that's one of those things that has sort of got through to the mainstream because it sounds so ridiculous. Why would feminists care about that? God, it's so stupid. You know, they got nothing better to worry about. Everyone knows it means he or she. And that's certainly the position that I took until reading this book, which pointed out that when women hear these words, they picture a man. And that line changed my life because for the first time, I realized that I was picturing a man when I heard these words. Mm. And then I just thought, how have I never noticed this? I am always picturing men when I don't know the sex of the person we're talking about. And I'm 25, 26, and somehow I've never noticed that I'm always picturing the opposite sex. And that was so shocking to me. And so I think that, you know, that's the reason I always get hung up on women being made invisible, because they had been made invisible in my own head. And so I recognize the power of that. But then to realize that it was, as I said, you know, happening in this field that we think of as objective and neutral and fact-based was incredibly shocking. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And once I couldn't stop thinking about it, I started to see it everywhere.
When I spoke to you in March, you said, and this actually stuck with me for a long time, but you said, we have unconsciously just presented the world as male. And that because of this data gap, people responsible for building the world that surrounds us, they're just looking through this prism of the male default. Mm-hmm. What does that tell us about the way women are viewed in society?
Well, women are viewed as atypical. Mm. We're a niche minority, you know, and it goes all the way back to Aristotle, who infamously said, the first departure from type is indeed that the male should become female. And he talked about women as mutilated men. Nice. And this, you know, continued all the way through for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, you still have in the Renaissance anatomical drawings where, you know, female bodies are labeled as the female version of a male thing. So the uterus was, I think, the female scrotum, and ovaries are the female testes, you know. And they are up inside the body rather than dropped down as they are in normal standard humans, because women lack vital heat. Oh. You know, that's the idea. We're missing something. There's something wrong with us. And this sort of carries on through, again, like in the 20th century even. You've got Le Corbusier, this really influential Swiss architect who came up with this idea of the human scale, which was the idea that you should build buildings to serve people, which is, you know, great, revolutionary, radical idea. The only issue is that for him, human meant a 6-foot police, male police detective. British police detective. Okay. It's very, very specific. You know,
yeah, the ultimate human endeavor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's very, very odd. And they belatedly considered the female body to create modular woman. So that's modular man. They were going to create modular woman, but the female body is too unharmonious. Oh. So can't possibly design buildings around this unharmonious body.
I mean, certainly for me as well, one of the most enormous changes of mindset that I had after reading Invisible Women was how much I'd internalized exactly that I had actually been thinking of myself as an addition or a version of the superior male without ever thinking of myself as inferior. I had yet still said things like, I have small hands. I've always said it, I have small hands. Mm. And then I read Invisible Women and I realized, I don't have small hands. I have average hands for a woman. Mm-hmm. But I'd been thinking of myself in comparison to the default male. Mm. Why have I been doing that? And then as soon as I realized that, I realized I've done it with everything. I've always called myself short. I'm not short. I'm average height. Mm. I just meant compared to a man. Why am I constantly comparing myself to a man? And as soon as I realized that, firstly, I was incredibly cross with myself for having wasted so much time
And then secondly, I had to really interrogate what that meant for how I had navigated my life and how I considered myself. I'd made myself inferior and I'd made male the default. And that's probably affected just about every aspect of my life. And so on an individual level, even before we get to designing a kitchen and whether or not I can reach the top cupboards, it's about our attitudes towards ourselves. Mm. And I hadn't sort of fully realized that I'm not in comparison to a man. I am in comparison to me, or at the very least, the entire population of women. I'm not small. Mm. And I'd made myself smaller than I needed to be. What a daft thing to do.
So you went to Parliament to hand deliver books to the MPs, 650 of them. And how did they respond?
I knew that all 650 wouldn't turn up. Mm-hmm. So we had about 75 on the day, which is a lot for that kind of thing, particularly as it was a busy day. And the majority of those who came were just super excited. They were really thrilled and they understood what I was doing. And, you know, quite a few of them said, I've already bought the book, but I will pass on this copy to, you know, a constituent or a parliamentary assistant or someone else. And there were some conversations there with a couple of people who they hadn't thought about the gender data gap at all. Mm. And they hadn't thought about the fact that there's no sort of gender impact analysis on a lot of policies, or, you know, there's no requirement to consider women when you're applying for government funding for various things that will affect women. And so we were able to have those conversations. You know, there were a couple of people who said, I'm going to do something about this. I mean, whether or not they do remains to be seen. But certainly the talk was talked, and I was very pleased with the response of the MPs who did turn up. It speaks volumes to me, those who didn't come, in terms of, you know, Christopher Chope was never going to turn up to collect
very
his book.
Very disappointed that yes. Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab.
Yes.
Not surprised by Dominic Raab.
Well, very, very shocked.
I mean, maybe after reading the book, he'd call himself a feminist.
None of the conservative leader contenders turned up. I was hoping for at least a Rory Stewart or one of the.
Yeah, come on, Rory.
Yeah,
I could think you're all woke.
Yes.
Where were you?
But, you know, in terms of those people, I will be delivering the book to their constituency office with a note.
Sternly worded.
Yes. So the more power that somebody has, the more important it is that they get this book. So I will probably spend more time pointing out some of the things that are relevant to various people. But in terms of doing the parliamentary event itself, it did the job, which is firstly to promote the fact that we'd done this to the media and to the general public. Mm-hmm. So people can see, no, we are actually talking to the people in power who are responsible for making the decisions that will fix a lot of this stuff.
So one of the sections in the book is about politics. Mm. It's about public policy. And yes, it's about data, but it's also about representation. And you know, perspective is also a form of data. Experience is a form of data. And women bring different experiences to public office. Working class women from Birmingham bring different experiences to public office than middle class women who are half Argentine, let's just say, just to pluck an example out of nowhere.
Not mentioning any names.
Mentioning no names at all. You know, so it is incredibly important. We have this wide range of voices and perspectives and people. And that is absolutely a sex and gender issue. You know, it should be 50-50 in Parliament, but it's also a class issue, and it's also an ethnicity issue, you know, and it's also a disability issue. Like I was in Glasgow giving a talk, and there was a woman who spoke after me who is, she's got MS and has to use a walking stick, and you know, was talking about these things that I'd never considered. Like, for example, the disabled room in hotels is often absolutely useless for her. In fact, the worst room she could use because it's designed for people in a wheelchair. Mm. And so everything's too low for her. And things like as well, she said a really common problem is, again, toilets. I've become head of the head of feminism's toilet division. But there also is a head of disabilities toilet division because, you know, those cords that hang down.
Yes.
She said people often wind them up because I guess they're like, oh, it shouldn't be on the floor, that's disgusting. Mm. But they have to reach down to the floor, because the whole point is if a disabled person falls over, they can reach the cord. And so people think that they're being helpful and cleanly, and actually they're just making this thing completely useless for a disabled person who really needs it. And I'd never heard of either of those things, and neither of those things would occur to me as someone developing public policy. But she knows about it because she's experienced it. And with the best will in the world, you know, a white middle-class man called Christopher from Surrey doesn't know what it's like for all the other people with different experiences. How can he possibly design public policy for them? Mm. He just can't. He can design public policy that is great for white middle-class men called Christopher from Surrey. And he can inform himself to a certain extent, but there'll be things he just won't have thought of. You know, like, I love that story from Sheryl Sandberg's book Lean In, where she talks about how she got pregnancy parking put in at Google. Mm-hmm. And she realized, because she got pregnant and she was really struggling to walk across the car park, and because she was in a position of leadership, she could go to the head of Google and say, put in pregnancy parking. Mm-hmm. And he said, of course, I'd never thought of it before. And why would he have? He's never been pregnant.
No. I don't think we can make Christopher from Surrey care is the issue, but there are plenty of people in positions of power in Parliament who care. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the ones that will take invisible women and will do something about it. I also think that, I mean, there were a couple of MPs that I spoke to, male MPs, who I think don't understand the issues. And even when they read the book, it will still be very much an academic thing for them. Mm. But they will understand that the world that they live in, they have to do something about this, whether or not it's because it's vote winning or because it looks good, you know, in the wearing and this is what a feminist looks like t-shirt kind of, you know, cool credentials. But I do think, you know, that impetus comes from all sorts of people. It doesn't, you know, I don't have to run for office to make a difference. But what I can do is do a GoFundMe to get a copy of this book that you've then written. You're not going to run for office either. We can't all run for office. What we can do is knock on the offices.
And I read that the book's already inspired the Scottish government to set up a working group on data and statistics.
Yes.
So in an ideal world, what do you hope that MPs will do?
Firstly, I mean, there are a couple of really big things for me. I mean, awareness is a very general, sort of slightly subjective, non-measurable thing, but, you know, awareness is a good goal to have. The funding for things like scientific research, if it's for medicine that's going to be used on women, or if it's for anything that is going to be used on or used by women, that research, I think, is a condition of any kind of public funding, should have some sort of sex disaggregated data provision, or, you know, consider. I mean, an easy example is this just going to be tested on male mice? Mm-hmm. Because if so, then
you're not getting your funding.
Yeah. So I would like to get to that. Like, that's a big, tangible thing that can be done. And some EU funding does already, not all, but some EU scientific funding does already have that provision. So I would like to see actual action there, because I think that would make a very tangible difference to women's lives. The very boring stuff like road design and transport infrastructure and public transport.
What do you mean boring?
Like, for me, that's not sexy stuff for me. I like, you know, I like science. I don't like road planning.
Outrageous.
I know, but
getting sassed by my
however but as you've already indicated with the travel pattern stuff and the trip training, actually that's a massive important feminist issue. So, you know, if our Department for Transport actually said we have to do a gender impact assessment for every single thing that we do now, and in fact, you know, every policy, every new law, every law that is revised, everything that the government does, they should first ask the question, how will this impact women? We don't know because we don't have the data. Okay, let's get the data first. Mm. And if we did that
would be so amazing.
I mean, that would, we'd be like Sweden in a matter of months.
it would just be so incredible. Because the thing is, even when they do what they call gender impact assessments now, they're just such a tick box exercise and they're not really looking at it properly. And it would just be so amazing if they actually started to properly do it and collect the data. And you know, I'm talking about this like it's this amazing, you know, nirvana idea, but it should just be basic. You know, we're half the population. Why should we have to fight for this? It's ridiculous that we have to fight for this, but we do have to fight for it.
But that's what, as soon as you pointed out,
the first thing people do is deny it. Well, surely not. That can't be the status quo. What, we just don't test medicine on women? And then when you show them the proof, which is why it's really important to have a book you can smack them around the head with, you show them the proof, then they're like, oh, well, then we have to fix it. And actually, it doesn't take that many people in a position of power to fix something I have discovered, which is why, you know, which is, I think that's why you have to go to the top. Yeah. You know, as unsexy as it is to say, I want money to buy a book for people who already have money, the wider point that's being made, actually, that's the fastest way into affecting real change. I mean, it's that or some sort of guerrilla activity that we do like the suffragettes did, and you know, we're kind of not really in those days anymore. So I think actually the way that you get stuff done now is you go and knock on some doors in Parliament and say, do this.
So Tracy, when I chatted to you in March at the start of the crowdfunding campaign, you said to me, we knew we were second-class citizens, but we couldn't prove it before. And do you think that this explains why the books resonated so deeply with women? Like, it just kind of confirms that everything we've been feeling for a long time, that maybe things we weren't even, like, aware of. Like, it just kind of is like, oh, that's why.
Yes, and, I mean, that was one of the big revelations for me, was that I had sort of low level just known through little interactions, you know, seemingly trivial things, like I was getting wrist pain from my big smartphone, or, you know, I'm a gamer and I get wrist pain when I'm playing my Nintendo Switch, which is a handheld console. I sit up in bed and I play it, which is very healthy behavior. And I was starting to get wrist pain from that. And it wasn't until Caroline's book came along that I realized, and I looked into it specifically on the gaming side of things, that actually this stuff is just designed around average male hand span, and women have a smaller average hand span than men. We have, on average, lower grip strength, shorter forearms, etc. All these things that actually my phone is too big and heavy for my hand. And I've got around that by putting, I've got like a sticky holder thing on the back so I can just hold it without it actually causing pressure on my hand. But, you know, Apple haven't, They've you know, if they brought out a pink iPhone, you know, for women, obviously we'd all be up in arms because it's unnecessary. But what they didn't do was, when they started to make their screens bigger, they didn't think, can, you know, half of the population actually comfortably hold this? Or if they did think that, they didn't care. But, you know, so I spoke to Microsoft about the way that the Xbox controller was designed, and they hadn't considered women's hands. They considered children's hands and they considered men's hands, and they pretty much just consider, you know, the people in the office, but they hadn't considered women as a discrete group, even though women are now the largest gaming group. So it was, yeah, it was like, oh, okay, all of those little irritants, that's aside from I might die in a car crash, all the little irritants, why are my top kitchen cupboards too high? And then if I stand on a stool, I might die, because if you fall from the height of a stool, you're more likely to die than if you just trip over on the floor. And so women who are standing on step stools to get to the top cupboards, and they fall off, especially elderly women, they fall off, and then they die, or they break a wrist and they're out of action. And then you start to think about it, and you're like, it's not a little thing. It's not just my phone. It's not just my Switch. It's not just my kitchen cupboards. It's everything. And then you get really mad. And then you stay mad. When does the anger go away?
So great
so,
for our health.
Yeah, I've labelled the women who've read the book my monstrous regiment of furious women, which, and I love them, and they're really getting into it.
Oh,
you know,
that.
my mentions are just, I mean, my mentions are basically unmanageable now, because it's just full of women spotting all these inequities and telling me about them, which I love, so long as they also tag the people who can actually change it.
Yes.
So I was getting lots of people tagging me about toilet queues, and I was really pleased that women were noticing it, but also I'm not actually head of feminism's toilet division, and so I can't magically fix all the toilets. So I've started telling people to tag, you know, the train station or the venue, whatever it is, and they have.
That's really good.
And they are getting responses.
Yeah, I think, was it King's Cross changed their toilet provision?
Paddington.
Yeah.
That was my
my
angry tweet. So basically they for months had closed one of the women's toilets. So men had two and women had one. And so every time you went to Paddington, there was this queue out of, you know, not just out of the toilet, out onto the concourse, out of the lobby of the toilets, all the way around. Because there weren't enough for women, and there was no queue to be seen for men, because they had far more than they needed. So they reassigned some of the men's to women's. Now women don't have to queue for as long. For those of the listeners who are wondering what on earth is that about toilets and couldn't women just hurry up, I imagine I don't have time to explain the whole toilet issue, but buy the book and find out. And it's not about women taking too long. It is about structural sexism.
Yeah, and which is a thing that I've seen people saying that in your mentions, I think.
Yeah, why can't women just hurry up?
Right.
You know, yeah. That's what we're doing. We're just lingering in this gross public toilet just for laughs.
There
was a really funny tweet from someone, I can't remember the name, but a man had said, you know, well, women take ages gossiping in the toilet and doing their makeup. And a woman replied, yes, and men are just having fights and talking about football in their toilets. You know, to highlight the absurdity of course that's not what we're doing. We're very conscious there's a queue. We're going as fast as we can. Mm. We just have different needs.
And fewer toilets, actually. Yes. We have less provision and also more need. So we've got sort of about a quarter of the toilets that we need. Yeah. So that's why there's a queue. Exactly. Nothing to do with makeup. Because we're not queuing for the mirrors anyway. We're queuing for the cubicles, and no one's doing their makeup in a stinky cubicle.
No. It's actually disgusting.
I mean, you just want to get out of there. And you're right. Like, we do. When there's a queue, women are rushing. You know, they come out of the cubicle not having done up their trousers properly yet because they are aware that, and of course, because of the way women are socialized, we are socialized to be pro-social. So, of course, we're not taking ages in there.
The book's had an enormous response online. Obviously, we've talked about scores of women who are like, yes, finally. But also, I think you've had a lot of like mansplaining too. A lot of people who don't want to believe that this is a thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a mixed bag from men. I would say the majority has been really positive, mm-hmm. and that's been fantastic. Most men, I would say, have responded to reading the book by saying, this is how I'm going to fix things, which is brilliant. And they give me examples of how they're going to fix it. But there are men, and I think that they're basically men who haven't read the book, because I don't actually believe anyone could read the book in good faith and come away thinking, oh, this is fine, there's no problem here. You know, because even if you don't care about women at large, you care about your mum. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want her to be in a car that she's 17% more likely to die in than you are, or for her to die from a heart attack. And in fact, I've had lots of people getting in touch with really sad stories about their mothers or friends dying from heart attacks. And that includes, you know, a guy, it was his mother had died from a heart attack, precisely because her symptoms hadn't been recognised. But yes, there has been a fair amount of mansplaining going on. One of them is pee quicker. Some of them is just sort of outright, you know, stop whining, which is just incredible, really. You know, we're talking about women dying. No, I'm actually going to carry on whining about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, to be honest.
Yeah.
If the government came to you and said, help, tell us what to do.
Collect sex disaggregated data.
Yeah, that is absolutely the best step.
It's just a one-line answer, really. Collect sex disaggregated data and then use it.
Think about women sometimes.
Stop forgetting women.
Yeah.
Well, okay. But, I mean, women are 50% of our population, so think about women 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
It is a simple answer and a really complicated answer. Yes, think, you know, collect sex disaggregated data as a very first thing. Mm. Secondly, inform all policy, funding, law, etc., based on the needs of 50% of the population. I think if you're a woman in power, then it's a different question for you, because you have probably navigated some extraordinary male defaults structurally to get to be a woman in power. And oftentimes you find that, and less so now, but historically, some women in power don't like to stick their neck out over feminism, because actually they have gone through so much to get where they are. And it's such an easy thing to knock women off their perch with. Oh, she's a feminist, she's always going on about that, we can dismiss her. But for men in power, which is the majority of people in power, my message will be read the book first.
Yeah.
Just read the book.
Collect your coffee.
I like that suggestion.
Well, and I think it becomes obvious from there. Once you've read the book, you know what to do.
That was wonderful. Thank you both so much. I've loved this entire conversation.
If you liked this episode of History Becomes Her, please subscribe, rate, and review. If you have suggestions of history-making women we should feature on our podcast, or you simply want to get in touch, find us on Twitter at HBHpod, and you can find me on Twitter at RVT9. History Becomes Her is a Mashable podcast created by Rachel Thompson and Maria Demenzi. Our artwork is by Vicky Leiter. Our music was produced by Christiane Straker. Special thanks to Shannon Kanellan and Nikolai Nikolov. And why not check out our sister podcast, Fiction Predictions? Thank you so much for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.